Okay, we've got a special installment for our Gold Seek listeners today. John Williams from ShadowStats.com.
Well, my featured guest today says the economic collapse of 2008 and 2009 really led to a great recession that may still be underway. There just hasn't been the recovery reported by the mainstream media outlets. John Williams from ShadowStats joins us on this holiday. Happy Thanksgiving, John Williams.
Well, and a happy Thanksgiving to you, too. Thank you so much for having me.
You've really disseminated some fascinating information. This would have some folks burned at the stake a few generations ago. According to your work, if you can believe the headline numbers, unemployment in this country, national unemployment, peaked at around 10% during the Great Recession, and since then has slowly declined to under 5%. I think it was 4.8 or 4.9 at last look. You're not convinced of this. Your numbers say that the alternative unemployment measure, which counts discouraged and displaced workers, actually remained static at around 20 to 23%. It impacts every level of the economy. Give us the implications of your work.
I've been a private consulting economist for 30 plus years, and early on I found I had to get a real solid idea as to what the government was doing with their numbers in order to give meaningful forecasts to my clients. What I found over time was that what the government was reporting, those numbers were diverging. Over time, I found that basically Main Street USA has a lot better idea of where economic reality is than the headline economic statistics. A lot of it is how you define the numbers. With the unemployment rate, it's very specifically a matter of definition, where the headline unemployment rate, the one that right now is down at what some on the Fed are claiming is a full employment level of 5%, roughly 5%. That's nonsense. The way they define it, it's a measure of, to be counted as unemployed, you have to be out of work and you have just been actively looking for work in the last 4 weeks. It's a matter of definition. To be counted as unemployed, in the headline numbers, you have to obviously be out of work, but you also have to have been actively looking for work in the last 4 weeks. If you haven't been actively looking for work, let's say you've been unemployed for 6 months and you're just not finding any jobs and you give up looking for, but you still want a job, the government considers you a discouraged worker. It's a term they use. And they'll put you in a separate category that takes you out of the headline labor force. The headline labor force, when you look at how they calculate the unemployment rate, the labor force is just the number of employed plus the number of unemployed. And the unemployment rate's the number of unemployed divided by the labor force. So if you're counted as unemployed and a part of the labor force and the unemployment rate's at 5%, that's a much lower level of unemployed count than I see. And the guy who's been unemployed for a period of time and has stopped looking, he just drops out. Drops out of the government's numbers. Now, they'll count him for a while in the government's broadest unemployment measure. They have six measures called U6. And there he'll be counted a year as a discouraged worker, but after a year, he's no longer counted as a discouraged worker, just dropped from that. The difference is right now that the headline unemployment's around 5%. The U6, which is the broadest government measure, is around 10%. But once they drop out of the headline measure, and the same thing happens after a year, if they're discouraged, they're no longer counted. Well, back before 1984, when they changed the system around, and that's because we were getting NAFTA put into place, and there was a lot of expectation that it was going to cost people jobs, and it wouldn't be too good a political idea to show the real long-term discouraged workers. So they changed the way they defined the series. If you add back in the long-term discouraged workers, the displaced workers, occasionally economic downturns as we've had, I estimate it's up around the unemployment rate right now is up around 23%. Putting that in perspective, I'll contend that if you went around the country was unemployed, that's about the number you'd get. It's because of the underlying reality there. The economy is worse than what the government's reporting, probably more so than anything else that gave us the political overthrow we've just seen in the presidential race. Mr. Trump picked up on the fact that people responded, and he's now the president-elect. What's happening here? Back in 92, George Bush was running for re-election. The economy had been in a recession, and there were people associated with the administration who went out and GDP numbers boosted the GDP. The recession ended. Hip, hip, hooray, except that nobody believed it. George Bush didn't get reelected. Economic well-being, the pocketbook issues, more than anything else, tend to drive presidential elections. And you can see that when it's been below generally 3%, when the real disposable income has been below 3%, adjusted for inflation, the incumbent party has always lost the White House. That's since 1932 when you have the first numbers. Other issues, of course, here other than just the employment. You have the payroll employment. You have that's probably more of a market driver than the unemployment rate. It's a survey that's conducted of industry in terms of how many people they have on payrolls. So that if someone actually has a part-time job, or two part-time jobs, or three part-time jobs, where the payroll gets reported to the government, they're counted three times as being a household survey where you only get counted once, irrespective of how many jobs you're holding down. So when you see a surge in payrolls, that sometimes reflects more people taking on multiple jobs, but they also have upside bias factors that were added into that system back in the 80s. In the coming out of the 1983 recession, the Bureau of Labor Statistics was in an embarrassing political situation where they actually underestimated the number of jobs being created coming out of that recession. So what they did was they put in what they called a bias factor, adding in about 160,000 jobs per month for good measure, so they didn't have to worry about understating the employment. And that varied some over time, and as they received some criticism on it, they formalized the model. Now it's called the birth-death model, but basically it's a fudge factor, adding a couple hundred thousand jobs a month in there for good measure to keep the numbers on the plus side. The GDP. Now that's the broadest measure of the U.S. economy. It's what most people will follow. You say, what's the economy doing? They'll look at the GDP and say, oh, here's what the GDP's doing. Well, it's the broadest measure of the economy. It's currently published, but it is very heavily politicized, very heavily gimmicked, very heavily modeled. If you believe the GDP reporting, the economy crashed from late 2007, collapsed into 2009, and then rebounded. And it now stands about 13% above where it was before the recession, above the prior peak in the economy before the recession. That's adjusted for inflation. That's the way they normally look at it. The problem is there's nothing else that's showing that. If you look at industrial production, which accounts for roughly 65% of the GDP, right now that's down something like 1.5% from its pre-recession peak. The manufacturing sector there is down 6% from its pre-recession peak. Never recovered. Retail sales are higher, and there's some reasons for that. Basically, poor quality and adjustment for inflation. But even there, with the spiked numbers, they're up 5% from the pre-recession peak. You look at elements such as the cash freight index. Broad measure of freight activity, broad measure of economic activity. It's down year to year, still falling. You look at housing. You're down, depending upon the measure, anywhere between 30 and 60% from the pre-recession peak. Very difficult to come up with that kind of growth that they're advertising in the GDP. And as a result, most people don't believe the GDP numbers. They also think that inflation is understated, and they're correct. Again, it's a matter of definition. And in this case, you had a very open effort by the government to understate inflation. Changes that were made go back to the 1980s, but where it came before the public was in the 1990s with Alan Greenspan, and who headed a commission with his name. The way Greenspan explained it was that the CPI overstated inflation. And if only it stated inflation correctly, it would save the government a lot of money because it wouldn't have to pay as much in cost of living benefits for things such as Social Security. It would also push people into higher tax brackets so they'd pay higher income taxes. Well, if you ask them, what are you talking about? And how is it overstating inflation? The example he'd give is, well, suppose steak gets very expensive. People buy more hamburger instead of steak. Their cost is not going to be as high, therefore their cost of living is less, but that's not reflected in the CPI. Well, this is where you get into definition, because that is indeed a matter of definition. Additional consumer price indices, and this is the way it was up until they started changing these numbers, measured what's referred to as maintaining a constant standard of living. If you want to use a CPI measure to estimate how much your income has to increase by or what you're targeting your investment return at in order to stay ahead of inflation, you want to be able to do so that you don't have to cut back on your standard of living. You want to be able to maintain your standard of living consistent with at least with what's happening in inflation. And if you have to cut back on steak because it's getting too expensive relative to hamburger and buy more hamburger, that's not maintaining a constant standard of living. So what they did was they moved to change the CPI to sort of a substitution-based index. It hasn't been done fully successfully yet. They've made all sorts of gimmicked changes to the CPI, but they've also developed a new series called the CPI, the CCPI, the chained CPI, which in the not-too-distant future, we'll see what happens with the new government, but as it was planned, would become the new cost of living measure that would enable them to further cut cost of living adjustments for people on Social Security. If you're on Social Security and you don't think the payments that the increases you're getting cover your cost of living, you're absolutely correct. And it's designed that way basically to save the government money. The government is not putting out a more accurate CPI measure. It's not putting out a CPI measure in terms of what do I need to stay ahead of inflation. They just redefined it so that they'd come up with the smallest inflation possible that cut their expenditures. So you have factors like those. The inflation changes affect the reported growth rate. You look at the GDP, not as strong as advertised. One reason for that is that it has in it very low inflation numbers that are used in deflating the series. When you're looking at economic growth, you only want to look at it with inflation removed. Let's say you run a store and you look at your cash register and your sales are up 10% from last year. Well, if inflation's up 10% from last year, then you're basically break even after inflation. It's important to know what inflation is. If you deflate by too low a rate of inflation, it increases the inflation-adjusted growth rate. And right now we're seeing a general understatement, inflation rate used in calculating the GDP. It's an aggregate number, about 2 percentage points, which happens to be just about what the GDP's been growing almost exactly, year after year, quarter after quarter, when you average it out. It's almost like someone was targeting 2% growth per year. The difference it makes, and what I'll contend has happened here, is that instead of the economy crashing from 2007 into 2009 and then rebounding, it started turning down late 2005, 2006, crashed indeed into 2009, and bounced off absolute bottom, but then it effectively leveled out at a low level of stagnation. And never recovered, and now it's starting to turn down again. you'll see that again. And then if you look at the housing numbers, you look at industrial production, you'll see it in a number of the broader employment measures that the government puts out, like the participation rate, which is also something along the lines of discouraged workers. You see that, see rates there that are indicating that low level of participation in the workforce, low level of the population that's actually employed. These are the lowest levels seen basically since 1994, which is when they redefined the series. So that it's there are a number of factors that are confirming it out there. It's just that you just have to take the headline government numbers with a large grain of salt.
Exactly. No, we keep our grains of salt in dump trucks at goldseek.com. You brought up some really interesting points. I'd like to underscore at least one of them that I think has broad-based implications for all of our listeners today. And this will be a bit repetitive, I think, for our longer-term listeners, but for new folks, it bears repeating. If inflation is understated, as I understand it, our GDP deflator is also incorrect. So it appears as though, according to the official numbers, that the economy might be in recovery and the recession is in the rearview mirror. But when we look at the shadow stats numbers that have been at least theoretically corrected, more realistic, plausible inflation numbers, you immediately see that we've been in a recession for approximately 15 years, that meaningful work is more difficult than ever to find, and the actual recovery just seems to be the 0.1%.
The other side of that is basically lost some of his what used to be very strong employment opportunities. And a good deal of that is tied to trade deals. Again, this brings you back to some of the current issues that are being discussed in Washington, and factors that, again, helped Mr. Trump in his campaign were the reasonably easy time identifying with the problem. The problem with the trade deals. Free trade is a wonderful concept, and I love people in academia, but the problem of some of the theories they come up with is that they're handling such complex areas that they have to make simplifying assumptions, and you got to look real closely at those simplifying assumptions because that can affect the way things evolve. And the simplifying assumption with the free trade concept is that you have, say, two countries that haven't been trading before, and one makes one product particularly with a particular efficiency, and the other country makes a different product with particular efficiency, and they open up trade, and most of the production of one product goes to the other country and the other to the other country, but overall you get greater aggregate production, greater wealth to the system, and it should be, in theory, a positive benefit to everyone. The underlying assumption is that you're at full employment, and that hasn't been the case here in a long time, nor has it been with most of our trading partners. And as a result, when you have that type of a circumstance, the benefit goes to the low wage operation, and that's why you have seen factories shut down in the United States and move to the people who otherwise, they maybe were a high-paid machinist, couldn't get a job. Now they flip hamburgers. They may be employed, but they're not earning adequate income. What you'll find is that with the government's numbers, this is from this published by the Census Bureau, and they keep revising the numbers some. But if you look at their latest estimates, what was referred to as a median household income. This would be the middle level of income for a household in the United States, adjusted for their headline inflation, the CPI, CPIU, this is the one that most people follow. That adjusted for inflation, that median income now is below where it was back in the 1970s and 1980s. If you look at real average weekly earnings as published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, peak was in 1973. It's been downhill from then. And it's the reason is largely tied to the loss of these the loss of the domestic productive base offshore and the higher paying jobs offshore. And again, that's a reason that you've had such economic disgruntlement. And again, some overturn in the political system and criticism of the trade deals. There are legitimate concerns there.
Let's move on to the U.S. dollar. Of course, the greenback has broken out to multi-decade highs recently. Many in the mainstream are at least citing the potential for another rate hike or two in 2017. And of course, we're certainly going to see one in the December FOMC meeting, a quarter point at least. Do you believe that we will see higher rates in 2017 by our policymakers? And can you tell us just what that might mean for the domestic economy?
Yeah, I think there's a good chance the Fed's going to raise rates in December. The problem is they haven't done so other than back in December of 2015. They've been threatening it ever since. But they're bluffed. The problem is that the banking system collapsed back in 2008, the panic of 2008. What the Treasury, the federal government did, I mean the Treasury and the Fed, did was basically use whatever stopgap measures they could put together without consideration of the factors that had actually generated the crisis, but to buy time, to push the crisis into the future. What the Fed and the Treasury did with that crisis in 2008, they decided that they would save the banking system at all cost. They did whatever they had to do to keep the system afloat, to push the crisis into the future. They stopgap whatever they had to bail out. They guaranteed whatever they had to guarantee. Bailed out General Motors. They purchased AIG, the largest insurance company. Bailed out the large banks. Whatever they had to do, they did. And they bought some time. But they did nothing to address the underlying issues, and the average country wants out of the U.S. Treasuries, not into them. Big buyers such as China, Japan, South Korea, they're all selling now. The biggest buyer had been the Federal Reserve. That's quantitative easing. I think they're not going to have much of a choice but to go back to that, because where they talk about launching their quantitative easing programs to help stimulate the economy, that's nonsense. The quantitative easing programs were launched to try and preserve the liquidity of the banks, to bail out the banking system. They used the weak economy as political cover, but they knew that what they were doing with quantitative easing would never stimulate the economy. The funds were not going into the economy. They were going into the banks. They were buying out off bad assets and providing the banks with liquidity. If the economy continues to turn down, which it looks like it's doing, they're going to be seeing increased stresses on the banking system. I think they've already committed to, again, salvaging the system, not letting it fail, although it effectively failed in 2008. They're still going to do whatever they can to keep the banks from collapsing, which will mean more quantitative easing. And when they move towards more quantitative easing, irrespective of whether or not they raise rates in December, you'll start to see very heavy selling against the dollar, because it means we're going to have much higher inflation down the road. And that's going to be the long-term, that's going to be the long-term issue. The U.S. has got it, whether the Trump administration, if they have all sorts of stimulus packages in hand, that's wonderful. But they have to get around the problems they have with the Fed. The Fed is not able to handle its current circumstance, and it has to do something to satisfy the rest of the world, so people will want to continue investing in the United States, which means putting together some kind of a long-range package to guarantee the solvency of the United States over time. Right now, we have, including what they call unfunded liabilities, current value of that, the programs in hand, well in excess of $100 trillion. That's double the global economy. There's no way that can ever be paid off. The system has to be brought into balance. And that's not going to be easy. It's not necessarily even going to be a politically popular thing to do. But if you want to have a system where you can look to returning to normal interest rates, and I think, if you're borrowing money, nobody wants to pay higher interest rates. But if you're living on a fixed income, it was nice when you used to be able to get a return on your CD that was where it was not more efficient from a monetary standpoint to just go out and buy canned goods, because canned goods are going to go up more in value over the next year than you're earning interest.
And, of course, we've also seen yields soar and bond investors panic, obviously ahead of the increased odds for a rate hike next year and higher rates to come in the United States.
I'm not looking at a normal economy here. I see some hope, of course, with the change in government. But I don't see. I mean, I'm hopeful that maybe something can be done. But frankly, I see the decades of living beyond our means and taking on obligations that could never be covered as being intractable.
Do you believe the globalists are setting up the new regime, because here we have the threat of higher rates, which is certainly not a positive for the housing market, you know, not to mention, the equities markets.
The higher rates are used to be normal. The issue here, though, what you've got to look at is a possibility here of a very dangerous inflation circumstance. That is set over time. I mean, if there's no change made to the obligations of the United States and our ability to meet them, eventually you're going to see a runaway inflation. That's just the effect of paying off things that you can't, you don't have covered otherwise with money you've got to print to cover it. It debases the currency. You end up with a hyperinflation.
Right. In Venezuela, we're seeing one silver coin purchase $250 in groceries right now.
Well, That's the direction I'm afraid we're going in, even with positive changes here. But however that goes, you need to be covered in that area. And the way an individual can protect himself is to buy physical gold and silver and hold it. I prefer sovereign coins because they're liquid. Have some of your assets in that. You can write out most anything. You also probably should have a stock of emergency supplies, as you would for a natural disaster. This being a man-made disaster, get stuff that you can roll over the inventory on. But if we get into as difficult a time as I think we have ahead of us, and this very easily could be in the next year or two, if prices get out of control, if the currency becomes worthless, you don't know that deliveries are going to be made to grocery stores. How are you going to get gas out of gas stations that are denominated in a couple of bucks per gallon? There are all sorts of issues that come with it. Eventually, the system will adapt. It'll adjust. You might end up with a barter system for a while. I imagine you'll eventually end up with a new currency. But it's best to have a little bit of buy yourself a little bit of an insurance policy so that you can ride out the rough times.
Do you see any dislocations or things that investors should be watching for on the horizon?
Okay, looking at what investors should look at, follow the dollar. Look at the dollar. If it's you hear talk of heavy selling with the U.S. dollar, and coincident that, would you probably see some sharp rallying in price of gold and silver? I'd get very nervous, and I'd get, if you already don't have some, get some physical gold, but hold it through the crisis. It doesn't help you as a hedge. For example, you buy the gold, let's say you buy gold at $1,100 or $1,200, where you are now. Gold gets up to $10,000 an ounce. What the gold does is it preserves the purchasing power of the money that's put into it. And if you're going to end up in a system where the dollar, let's say, becomes worthless, you want to hang on to that gold until the system has resolved itself. Because what might be 10,000 in gold could become 100,000 gold, could be 100 million, who knows? But it's not, what it does is, again, is it preserves the existing purchasing power. It keeps your assets from becoming worthless. which they would if you just held them in paper.
Very good. All right, John Williams, we appreciate you taking time today during this holiday. And while feeling under the weather, any other contact information you'd like to leave with the listeners?
Yeah, I think you got it, shadowstats.com. Always happy to hear from people looking at the site and interested in what we're doing.
John Williams, we appreciate your thoughts. Please feel better soon. We look forward to hearing more from ShadowStats in 2017.
Again, thanks for having me, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.